You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and I am welcoming you to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist here on Radio Albion. Today's date is the 26th of July, 2023, the feast day, the appearance of the Archangel Gabriel. Now, I don't know if you have noticed, but the Orthodox Nationalist and what came before really is a series of lectures dealing with maybe six or seven topics, very broad topics and very important topics, but in very different ways each time. Every once in a while, there's an oddball out there, but in one form or another, it's really a handful of topics that get treated with different emphases. One of them is the fact that in any political system, the choice is between oligarchy and the common good, or some version of nationalism or monarchy or whatever. That's unavoidable, and every system will eventually fall into one or the other category. Another is the fall of Byzantium, of Constantinople, both to the Italians and to the Muslims. And today we're going to do both. It's pretty obvious why oligarchy is going to be a topic here, really to the point where I'm advocating that economics be revolutionized in taking oligarchy, and not to mention globalization, into analysis. That's never going to happen. If you use market metaphors in 2023, you're going to come up with the crap that academia puts out. This is why none of their predictions ever come true. The same goes for Byzantium. In no way is the Western world, the Anglosphere, the Anglo-American world, remotely comparable to Byzantium. But whatever it is, we are witnessing and being forced to live through its dissolution, which can be very exciting, is extremely productive of a lot of intellectual work, particularly underground. And the system gets worse and worse and more absurd in trying to protect and control the flow of information that only it monopolizes. But of course, it's also a time of great suffering and increasing poverty. So you put this all together and you have the decline of the Byzantine state as an apocalyptic event. And that's really the central point here. And as both a cause and an effect of this decline, oligarchy takes over, actually imposed from without. I don't have to tell you that most of the work on Byzantium in the West is either excellent or unreadable. The excellent ones are a long time ago. Orthodoxy has done an excellent job, especially in Greek, in Russian, to lay out the cardinal principles of what Byzantium was. And as always in the Anglo-American world, like everything that's believed there, the work on, or the general beliefs about Byzantium are false and really the product of systematic myth-making. But the fall of really any empire, even those that are almost incomparable, like Byzantium in the U.S., the U.S. had just had a very short reign, there is an eschatological and apocalyptic component. Theology, as a manner of thinking, affects everything. It is the ultimate queen of the sciences. And coming from it directly is history and philosophy. Sort of the trinity of the mind. And everything comes from that. All the other sciences come from that. There is no event in the political or moral world that doesn't have some theological importance. But given the fact that Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire saw itself as both a continuation of Rome and Jerusalem, it took to itself an eschatological tone. It was, in fact, an apocalyptic entity. And for those living in the Eastern Roman Empire, long after the collapse of old Rome, the fate of the holy city, Constantinople, was essentially the fate of the universe. It was a central node of the cosmic order. Keep in mind, especially the early church, when you're talking about Rome, despite the fact that there were persecutions and many martyrs were produced, the Jews were essential, in fact, critical to these, denouncing the Christians to the emperor or to local authorities. In the New Testament, Rome is not, absolutely not, seen as an opponent. The Jewish elite murdered Christ by manipulation, both of the governor as well as public opinion. And of course, nothing has changed. Although ethnically, it's a very different group of people back then. There was no Talmud, but the foundations of it were laid at that moment on Good Friday. The Romans, of course, as anyone who bothers to read anything in the New Testament will notice, that the Romans didn't want this to happen. Somehow, especially Protestants, Protestantism is a disease. It's a disease of the mind. It's so destructive and distorting that, you know, it's a negation of not just Christianity, but any approach to truth. Interpret these things, Protestants interpret these things in a very arbitrary way. In fact, they have no conception of what it would be like to have a city as the nodal point in the Christian world. And especially with the rise of Islam and the heresy of certain elements of the West, well, it's understandable. Although there are plenty of Protestants out there who will tell you that the American Constitution is divinely inspired. Can you imagine such a thing? Although it's pretty rare that you'll find a Protestant scholar who knows anything about these topics. Protestant fundamentalists, is what I was going to say, spend a lot of time trying to deny that the Jews were at the forefront of the execution of Christ, and in fact the Romans were on the other side. The Jewish elite, typically arrogant, the Pharisees and those hangers-on were dedicated to the overthrow of Rome. And from then on, the concept of Rome became the enemy. It's in the Jewish Encyclopedia. It's in the Talmud. You see it symbolically represented in the Zohar. It's everywhere. Rome and everything that it symbolizes became the enemy, and they certainly understood the third Rome as Moscow, and therefore Tsar Nicholas had to be murdered. But New Rome and New Jerusalem, as far as Constantinople, now this is before Moscow really was thought of. Moscow was a solution to the problems of Constantinople. But it doesn't take a genius to see that the names, the descriptions of Constantinople connect both Romes together and all of history together. The philosophy of Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics, as much as, and integrated within the Gospel, taking what you can use and discarding the rest, like, you know, I do with Plato, as St. Justin Martyr did with Plato. St. Constantine, and especially Theodosius the Great, were aware of creating a new synthesis, a very different kind of polity. It contained the best of all worlds. And you see things like the Column of Constantine, which doesn't get talked about very much. It's this tall column. It's, you know, a variant of it is still there, that at one time had the statue of the emperor himself there and portrayed. Some of them claim that he is in the guise of Apollo, which wouldn't make any sense. But it's done in the same style. And he's wearing a crown of sunbeams, this radiant, you know. And then later, that was interpreted as the holy nails brought to Constantinople. Now, of course, the base of the column has been rebuilt 100 times. But at the time, Constantine brought many relics. And the other thing, allegedly, that was placed there was the Palladium of Rome. That statue of Athena, the little wooden statue of Athena that initially had been taken from Troy. Well, A, that's probably mythical, although Tertullian does mention it, and it's really not much of anything, and B, it was buried there. The entire thing could be a rumor, but that just begs the question, why is such a rumor coming to existence? So the old philosophy, whether Plato or the Stoics, was in and of itself a forebear of Yahweh, the Christian God, and that, in a broad sense, is what protected Constantinople. In 1106, there was a huge gale that caused the statue to fall over. And during the reign of Manuel, who died in 1180, put a cross on there instead, as if to complete the construction of New Jerusalem. But when you have both of those titles, of course, it's an eschatological entity. But what do you use for that? What we're talking about here is the apocalyptic approach to the fall of Constantinople, which it doesn't take a lot of work to realize how relevant that is for us. Remember, in the writings of the time, the emperor was just as fundamental as the church. The church wasn't seen as an entity capable of ruling itself, except as a martyric, suffering and scattered, non-institutional entity, pretty much as it is right now. But both the Old and the New Testaments were used. The Book of Daniel. Again, you have Protestants who can tell you their arbitrary interpretations of Revelations, but really haven't bothered to read Daniel or even the Apocalypse of Isaiah. You know, that it actually in the Book of Isaiah. The Book of Daniel works with Revelations. In Daniel, you have the dream of Nebuchadnezzar and the four beasts that arise from the sea. The sea is always a symbol of the feminine, the ever-changing chaos of mass opinion and arbitrariness and darkness. And they are likened to four kingdoms on earth that will succeed each other. And then, of course, there'll be a heavenly kingdom that will last forever. One of the symptoms of the Protestant disease is trying to quantify what these empires might be or how long these eras might exist. They tend to take numbers literally, having not the slightest conception of what numbers actually meant at the time. They think it's numerals. They have zero imagination because they have zero culture. So Daniel puts out the idea that any kind of earthly authority is temporary. Now, who the four kingdoms refer to is certainly not etched in stone, no pun intended. But it isn't as if you could identify these kingdoms, you can then identify what Paul meant by the restrainer, which comes up again and again and again in our work more recently. And that restrainer has to be removed before the horrible tribulation and then eventually the establishment of the heavenly kingdom. Many of you know in the 2 Thessalonians, chapter 2, it goes like this. Now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time, for the mystery of lawlessness is already working. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is removed. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of truth, that they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them strong delusions, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned, who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. These days, it's taken for granted that that restrainer was the last Roman emperor. Another reason why this is of immense importance. And the last Roman emperor was Tsar Nicholas II. The fact that the ritual nature of the killing explicitly made reference to that suggests that it's true. And the postmodern regime, the Marxist-capitalist combine, again, as you remember from last week, they're pretty much the same thing, intellectually, and now the singular postmodern hyper-real empire. But the last kingdom, a kingdom deriving from God, but of course of this world, and of course at the time in Byzantium, you know, Moscow was not an issue, but Rome and that and the restrainer, or the final Rome and the restrainer, were one and the same. And God may delay the end, so more and more people may come into the church. But both scripture and tradition emphasize that, of course, before this, as St. Paul says, there has to be a mass apostasy, as a matter of necessity, before Antichrist could function at all. Among other reasons, that there won't be enough people to understand what's happening around them, because of the, as he says, pleasure in unrighteousness. Now, in the Byzantine Empire, you had two similar but not identical approaches to this. One was that you identified the Byzantine Empire with the fourth empire of Daniel, and that follows the Assyrian, Persian, and Macedonian empire. I'm not committing to any of that, but I believe that's St. Jerome's understanding as well. That would imply that the Byzantine Empire would weaken in all respects, and fall as the tribulation arrives, and then eventually the heavenly kingdom will also arrive. The other, of course, is that Byzantium, or Rome, I shouldn't say just Byzantium, is the heavenly realm itself, or manifestation, incomplete manifestation of the heavenly realm, the so-called uncut mountain, which will destroy and succeed four kingdoms. In other words, Byzantium wouldn't then be completely historical in nature. It implies that Rome would last forever, and actually was almost a hypostasis, the shadow of God's kingdom. And the two of them aren't as different as might be suggested. But as far as Rome is concerned, of course, early on it was seen as a persecuting opponent. But it was also seen as something that God himself chose to make his revelation known, albeit at the fringes of the empire, but the empire nonetheless. Christ went out of his way to not be an opponent of the Romans. And this is one of the reasons they took him seriously. It's one of the reasons that Pilate wanted to speak with him and knew the irrationality of the crowd and the Jews that would rather see Barabbas. Well, that's no different than today. Now, one of the earlier commentators here is Saint Hippolytus of Rome, who died in 235. So he's a very, very early figure. He did identify the Roman Empire with the fourth, with the most terrible beast, and that the horn that grew out of it was, in fact, Antichrist. And for a while, his commentary became the standard one, definitely in the West, but possibly in the East as well. Now, it doesn't mean that Rome was irredeemable any more than Saul was at the start of his journey, but it has to be redeemed, which is exactly what the church did. But there were later Byzantine commentaries that were based on him. Many of you may have come across Seraphim Rose's edition of Andrew of Caesarea's view in the Apocalypse. But there's another as well, Edithas of Caesarea, kind of modified the Hippolytus' opposition between the Christian world on the one hand and the Roman Empire on the other. And Hippolytus gave an explanation of Daniel's prophecies, in which he and many other fathers, especially at the time, relates to Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, whatever, and Romans. But he also didn't believe that the second coming was imminent. He saw Rome as Christological, at least. But one of the things he also does is criticize those who saw the who were coming up with numbers and formula and all manner of simple math to pinpoint exactly when the second coming will arrive, despite what Christ said about the matter. He mentions the well-known stipulation that 6,000 years have to pass from creation to the second coming. And I think this is well known, anyone who studied him, that Christ was born 5.5 millennia after the expulsion of the garden, which would mean that 500 years had to pass from the birth of Christ to the consummation, and that will be the end. But given the fact that he's rejected this kind of mathematics, none of this should be taken literally. They're not numerals, they're numbers. They're forms. Now, I don't want to leave the Jews out of this, because they are a critical part of preparing the way for the Antichrist, and in fact producing Antichrist, as I've termed Adam Kadmon. But as far as the end times are concerned, Hippolytus says this. This is from his Refutation of All Heresies. And they, that is Jews, allege that their Messiah will be king over them, a warlike and powerful individual who, after having gathered together the entire people of the Jews and having done battle with all the nations, will restore for them Jerusalem, the royal city. And into this city he will collect together the entire Jewish race and bring it back once more to the ancient customs, that it may fulfill the regal and sacerdotal functions and dwell in confidence for periods of time of sufficient duration. After this rest, it is their opinion that war would next be waged against them after being thus congregated. And in that conflict, Christ will fall by the edge of the sword, and that, after no long time, would next succeed the termination and conflagration of the universe. And in this way, their opinion concerning the resurrection would receive completion and recompense be rendered to each man according to his work. Now, that's a tad diplomatic, but it is a minimum of how the church then and now, the best of it, understands the Jewish role in all this. Jews have played a role in the fall of recent empires, and their own empire, the one that we are forced to live in, is nearing the end. Their Messiah is the same person as Antichrist. What Hippolytus is saying here is that the sole purpose for the gathering together in Jerusalem is to rule violently over the Goyim. But when he talks about a warlike being, he's not just talking about a military apparatus. There simply aren't enough of them. They certainly have their mercenaries, as the Khazars did. There's no mention of the Khazar Empire here. Obviously, that would have to be a prophecy for that to be the case. But it means any number of things. Returning to the old customs is probably not on the agenda. But the symbols will be fulfilled in their mind, especially in the Zohar. And it comes down to what we call the Noahide laws. But this hadn't been developed at this early date. So I don't want to leave them out of this. The great Origen, again, another early figure, he died in 255, I think, also identified the union between the Roman and the Christian Empire. The point being, that the emperor's job was to try to convert as many nations to the faith as humanly possible. Now, Eusebius went a little further, and he argued that Rome itself was the final heavenly kingdom, replacing, in fact, manifesting and superseding all the other kingdoms in Daniel's famous vision. The difference really is whether or not Rome will fall in earthly time. Well, the book of Revelation strongly suggests that that's the case. But that doesn't mean that the final victory won't be the full manifestation of the heavenly kingdom, where Byzantium and Moscow, at their best, were only highly incomplete, the prosopon, or the face of this essence. So in his in Eusebius's tricentennial orations, his praise of Constantine the Great and his rule, and he cites the prophet Daniel directly. He says, "As concerning the rest of these beasts, they had their power taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and time. I saw the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days. And they brought him near before him, and was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed." And that's a quote directly from Daniel. It's quoted in Eusebius, but that's chapter 7, 12 to 14. Those who rule solely by man's will can't rule forever. It's non-sustainable. The Ancient of Days, God the Father, at least in most interpretations, and Christ, the second person of the Trinity here. And the nations that were saved serve him as nations. All people, nations, and languages would serve him. And that is everlasting. So, the way that Eusebius treats this citation from Daniel, the Roman Empire was the Christian Empire, and didn't really think in terms of the end. Didn't worry about, you know, calculations or anything like that, because the present age was the final one. Christ is present. Everything else is just variations on that theme. The time of Emperor Augustus, who ordered the census during the birth of Christ, that was a sign that the Roman and Christian empires had become one entity, and therefore the Roman empire would last forever. And it's things like, you know, the barbarian invasions, all that, those are simply temporary punishments and could never stop the empire as such. So most of the Byzantine interpretations of Daniel follow some variation of this. Either Roman Empire as the fourth and final one, or the, you know, some sort of collapse, or the empire as the fulfillment of God's plan of history. And, you know, contrary to the typical scholarship in this field, they're not really different. I'm sorry, they're not really contradictory. And of course, St. John in Revelations makes up the other half of this repertoire. And the thousand-year reign of God on earth is something that's supposed to take place after the captivity of evil in the world, but prior to the last judgment and the coming of the actual new Jerusalem, the heavenly kingdom as such. Now, it has been distorted in the Chiliast movement, but it refers to the Christian empire itself. And unfortunately, in the East, the book of Revelation had a bad reputation for a while, because not only was it very difficult to interpret, it became linked both to the Chiliastic and Montanist approaches to theology and condemned. But you had most of the church fathers arguing for its canonicity, Justin Martyr and Irenaeus, just to name two, but there were also apocalyptic thinkers. Eusebius tended to reject it, who didn't believe it was written by John. And it became relatively unfamiliar as time went on in the East. That changed in Russia, I should note. But Origen, as always, had a highly intellectualized and allegorical interpretation of Revelations. And his own work was enough to save it from rejection, because St. Jerome included it in his translation. He even mentioned that the book had been basically rejected by the Greek East. But Eusebius sealed its fate for a short time. In the West, it's a different story. Victorinus, Jerome, Venerable Bede all wrote on it to a great extent. In the East, it wasn't a huge deal really until the 7th century. And the three very suddenly appearing commentaries are Ocumenios, Bishop of Trica in Thessaly, and then Andrew of Caesarea, who I've already mentioned, and Aretas. Those are the three. St. Andrew of Caesarea, which St. Herman's Press has Seraphim Rose's translation of his commentary. But it's no accident that he wrote that in the 7th century, roughly 610, after the Persians had laid waste to much of the empire. There was widespread poverty and even famine. And his commentary removes itself from what is a strictly historical interpretation of Eumenius, but there was also a desire to calm the popular fear of the end, given the, nature of the times. But like all good interpreters, he will not relate current events and force it into the apocalypse. That's always a good idea. Christ had condemned this in the book of Acts. But of course, he also linked Babylon to an earthly city, however, comparing it with both ancient and new Rome. And he ends up by talking about the end, not just about the end of the world, but the end of your life as a person. He never engaged in any kind of prediction, but then brings it to a parallel with our own death. He saw the end in a fairly far away future period. Like so many at the time, he divides the history of the world to seven ages, the seven churches, seals, and each lasting a symbolic 1,000 years. Now, this is parallel to the history of the world divided into 6 general millennia. I don't mean literally that, but which corresponds to 6 days of God's creation, which is what St. Augustine did. His doctrine of the forms was that each day of creation is a Platonic archetype found in logos. But he rejected any calculations, which the Protestants are just obsessed with, because, he saw that we were in the sixth age, began with the coming of Christ, and will end with the last judgment, which there is no timetable there. And that precedes the seventh age, which is that of eternal rest. Now, I can't get into the doctrine of the eighth day, because those who accept the full 7 eras have a separate eighth day of eternal rest, where there is no longer any time, it's just an eternal now. The seventh day is connected with the post-last judgment universe. But the eschatological time frame you see in Greek more than in Latin. Andrew did the same thing. He wrote on the 7 ages, but he saw the 7th age, that is to say, the coming of Christ and the establishment of the church and empire, as the 7th. And he also ascribed to the Assyrian, Medes, Babylonians, Persian, Macedonian, or whatever combination, to the book of Daniel's succession of empires. And by empires, it's very possible to refer to principles of rule, other than literal beginning and end of a specific empire. That's really just an abbreviation. But Andrew writes this. He says, there are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. And I know it's tempting to put Moscow into that category. And as the one who is to come, because he is talking about crowns, He's talking about a throne. He's not talking about just any state, any government. And Moscow, of course, is a continuation of Rome, fully accepted by the Eastern Seas at the time. Eastern apocalyptic thinking, would be from St. Andrew or elsewhere, based on the idea that the present age in which the Christian empire rules is twofold. It is both a historical age, but also an age in which the ideal heavenly kingdom has been manifested, at least partly. So he says, the seventh age consists of both the present and the future repose, because the resurrection of Christ opened the kingdom of heaven, which is partially realized already, to be enjoyed by all the faithful in its fullness upon Christ's return. So their view of history, and I know I haven't even gotten to the later eras of Byzantium yet, but, and this was, you know, universal, in not just in Byzantium, but also Moscow, the present church and empire were a foreshadowing, the appearance of the eternal kingdom. That would make it a new Jerusalem. And Byzantine sources as early as 400 were describing Constantinople that way. Hagia Sophia, certainly the most important church prior to the establishment of St. Sophia in Kiev, it was meant to appear to be, architecturally, as foreshadowing heaven on earth. That's the square circle, the square as earth and the round dome, eternity and the heaven. And that merging, of course, was finished in 629. And that's also the date when the emperor stopped calling himself Autokrator, but then Vasilius. That simply was a fait accompli, because that was the reach and the power of the monarchy. So you have an optimistic and a pessimistic point of view, but both imply that we're going to go through a period of suffering. It's going to take a lot to convince me that we're not living in it right now. You know, we're talking about just a bit over 100 years since the fall of Tsar Nicholas, at the exact same time that flu was ravaging, you know, killed something like 20 million people. But, you know, it doesn't really end there. You know, this 100 years is being extended, despite the fact that what's happening now is far worse than anything that happened in Sodom. So, you know, the positive form of eschatology is the imperial one. But then there's more of a polemical, pessimistic one. And there's nothing, you know, they're not that different. But the apocalypse after the 7th century grew tremendously. And the worse off Byzantium became, the more powerful that preoccupation. So St. Andrew asked the question, how will our city, how will the New Jerusalem pass away? And here's what he says as an answer. About our city you shall know. Until the end she will fear no nation whatsoever, for no one will entrap or capture her, not by any means. For she has been given to the Mother of God, and no one will snatch her out of her hands. Many nations will break their horns against her walls and withdraw with shame, receiving from her gifts and great wealth. Now, that's certainly a positive approach. But he also adds the rule of the three young men who will rule the city jointly for 150 years, and they'll kill each other in a civil war, and that civil war will destroy so many people. Even a Pontian woman, the demon's daughter, will arise and rule the city. By the city, we're not necessarily talking about Constantinople. That's how it's normally interpreted. But this woman will eventually challenge God's power and is punished for it with the use of flooding and destruction. And then once the city passes away, he says the events of the end will begin. Again, they didn't have a conception of a third Rome that's going to arise later. That would have solved the problem if they knew about it. But this also means that, well, you know, you could talk about Constantinople as the New Jerusalem. Andrew also talks about it as Babylon. And they're perfectly consistent. The same thing happened in Israel. It was both at different times. You go from David to Solomon. So he produced an apocalyptic work. That is fairly ambiguous, but that's typical given how humans are. It's not really a debate. And it also depends on our perception. Now, Hippolytus of Rome was the last church father in the West that wrote in Greek. And the language barrier, the language barrier was, for the most part, not as serious as most people have made it. There were always ambassadors in entire sections. I mean, the Venetians had a huge section in Constantinople. To think that they were isolated from one another simply isn't true, although it's hard to deny that after 1204. But having the Western Empire really ceasing to exist and only arising on a temporary basis creates two different civilizations. But we all know in Italy, it reached a point where, southern Italy was Greek, but they realized that the empire wasn't strong enough to protect them. The destruction of, or the overrunning of the two seas, Antioch and Alexandria, they could have, they were both Petrine seas. But they were all living in Athens, in Constantinople for the longest time. They live in Athens for the most part right now. Now we get to the heart of the matter, and that's the connection between 1204, the Fourth Crusade, and the end of the empire. They're obviously linked. The empire was recaptured, but the wealth of the city, and I'm talking about actual wealth, the ancient statues and the gold and everything, was at the time in Venice or France or Florence. So much of the ancient and pre-Christian works that they had preserved either was destroyed or shipped to the West. The bronze works were melted down. The Palladia, those kind of traditional defenders of the city, were destroyed. Nicetas Chionates, who was the main historian of the Fourth Crusade, goes into great detail about the utter destruction, the shattering the city, and the theft of its most precious possessions. But what the Latin Empire tried to do was to go to the so-called oracles of Constantinople, use the carvings in the steles and going way back even to the Trojans, using some of these texts as a way to justify themselves, because they did destroy a city, and if they had a conscience, they needed to rationalize it. The only people who really benefited were the Muslims. There was the sculptures in the pillar, discovered by the more educated Crusaders, has a summary of world history carved into it. And the Latins thought that they were the only ones who could interpret that. The two bronze statues that that are mentioned in the text of the time. But Constantinople was eventually retaken, and the Palaiologian dynasty didn't succeed in rejuvenating the empire, at least not for very long. But the new Constantinople after that was based on a very different theory of kingship. The Byzantine emperors were judged according to their ability to restore the empire itself, taking lost territories, and ultimately bringing all of mankind together as nations into the faith. But from 1204 onward, the image of Byzantium had lost its power. There was a cycle of decline and restoration prior to 1204. After that, it was just a gradual decline. And needless to say, there's an awareness of the failings of the Byzantine Emperor, that they were deprived somehow of God's uncompromising support. Later Byzantines thought was very concerned with this. Remember, military victories or defeats were seen as divine symbol. Victory was something that God determined or not, especially as the Byzantines are defeated by the Turks, encroaching on their territory. In the 14th century, Byzantines looked inward to their own sins, just like the Synod Abroad did after 1921, looked into themselves. You know, what did Peter create? What did Catherine do? It's hard to do for anybody, especially those who lived through it. How can the Turks be winning? That's the same thing in Israel. I mean, how could Israel be divided and destroyed the way it was? And the great Ezekiel was very preoccupied with that. But there was a doubt now that the empire was eternal as a physical entity. Byzantium was no longer a final stage in history, just one empire out of many. From this comes the rise of Moscow, at least in the Christian conscience. So you have cyclical history up against the linear view. Now, the Orthodox history has always been cyclical. And if it's linear at all, it's a downward trend, which of course was changed in the Enlightenment. Cognatis, a great historian of the Fourth Crusade, he refers to Constantinople as an aged furnace woman, all covered with soot, and thy formerly glistening and delightful countenance now furrowed by wrinkles. The old woman image. But he also talks about renewal. He says, who shall be set over thee as another Moses to renew all things? So, I mean, the decline of the empire and the dissolution of the world, these testimonies grow. Some, such as John Gregoropoulos, who saw Constantine the 11th as a new emperor and hoped that he would, at that very late hour, revive Constantinople. This is why the end of the world loomed very heavy at the time. There was the tie between imperial and universal history seemed to be severed. And what the Russians said, both in Novgorod and in Moscow, that the turn to the West, the lack of faith, among many other things, is what is the sin of sins. Of course, I want to also argue that usury concerning the Italians and their eventual rule over the entire empire, Italians and Jews working together, had a lot to do with that, but that's also a turn to the West. I've written substantially on the Zealots. The Zealot movement was an attempt to stem this decline. They created a commune in Thessaloniki between 1341 and 1355. On my website, rustjournal.org, you see an older, I've revised it heavily since then, an older article on them. It's surprising how little, especially in the Christian world, has been written on it. But they were a movement to correct the decline and the corruption of the empire at a very late date. They recognized one very important thing. The power of the crown was disappearing, and when the power of the crown or any central institution fails, oligarchy takes over. In essence, that's what a revolution is. That the war of the poor, the infantry, the peasants, the monks, was certainly long in coming. And in Russia, the same thing occurred under Ivan, Basil III, and certainly Ivan the Terrible, were populist in that sense. And then it took Razin to rise against the slow rationalization, not to mention the new right and the centralization of political power on the Western model. But the Zealot commune really was all throughout Macedonia. And the Zealots saw Byzantium as slipping away. They were 100 years, it had fallen probably before then, in the sense that the wealth, the concentration of wealth in the hands of the landed and non-landed oligarchs was the problem. They rejected the new westernized state that kind of corruption required. And they demanded instead decentralization, a return to the Middle Ages. Like all peasant movements, they are reactionary. Now, there's not much in their so-called Republic of Thessaloniki in terms of sources. But whatever their flaws, they were trying to undo the damage of 1204. So the Fourth Crusade, there was an attempt to reverse it in 1261, where Byzantium was retaken. But from 1261 to 1453, that period of history itself was saturated with eschatological relevance. Once the empire goes, the church will struggle because it really can't rule itself very well. And soon, no matter what it does, it will be ruled over by foreigners. And the same warnings were given in Deuteronomy, ancient Israel. As I've said 9 million times, the principle of oligarchy, one of the main players in this decline, was Venice, who went very quickly from an ally to an enemy once the empire was reconstituted in 1261. It is the archetypal sea power at war with the archetypal land power. So the fall of the city was the victory of the sea, the victory of the Venetians. The gold and the jewels and the valuables of the empire after the Fourth Crusade were used to build the modern West. This was capital. I don't want to exaggerate this, but this was the capital that permitted the Italian states to loan at interest and to pay debts. But the Zealot movement was populist. Byzantium's decline was so tremendous, the putrefaction was so obvious, that the Zealot movement was the last attempt. The fall of Byzantium was the domination of money and the transformation of canonical rule into the worst aspects of feudalism, which of course never existed in Byzantium. Concentration of landed power into fewer and fewer hands was taken as normal. The crash, not really 1453, but it came from the rule of Italians and Jews using interest on loans as a way to gain power from a prostrate empire. They were Italian. They were sort of Catholic. The Jews were also extremely prominent. They monopolized the foreign and domestic trade of the empire, looking for assistance, but that assistance never came. And the Russians always say that they sold their soul, although its last emperor, of course, died an Orthodox martyr. He was not a Uniate. Its sovereignty was removed when the Florentines and the Venetians, but especially the latter, were granted tax-free status. And of course, the empire's Jews were intimate allies of the Italians, as they were far more enthusiastically with the Muslims. And I've always thought that Islam is a creation of Judaism. So Jews, a handful of secular lords, Italian merchants, were given extraordinary privileges while the peasantry died in the empire's wars. The state no longer had a moral purpose. You see this in the 17th century, especially in the Biron Vicina, the rule of the German Masons. Now, you would think that the oligarchy would maintain an army at a high level to quell unrest, but that would be very simplistic. People aren't rational. You see it in the oligarchy of Poland. No, the army was kept at an absolute minimum. There was no army in the Italian city-states. They were mercenaries that they paid. Same thing goes for Novgorod, to arise later in the north. The Greek oligarchy, too, reduced the army to nothing and dismantled the navy. That's how concerned with Italian security they were. So, after the death of Emperor Andronicus III in 1341, as John V Palaiologos crowned, but because he was very young, actual power fell into the hands of the head of the oligarchs, one of the wealthiest landowners in Thrace, and that was John Cantacuzinus. He became a regent. Of course, everything was based on force, provincial oligarchy. So, you know, of course, the end of Byzantium, the end of the empire in New Rome could never come without apostasy. And it was done, but not so much by capitulation to the Western Roman Church, but a variation of that in the rule of usury. Of course, John V and his regent were opposed. The young emperor's mother, Anna Savoy, and Alexis John Alexis Apokakis, who was Minister of Finance. Alexis was a naval man. He outfitted a powerful Greek fleet, and he had many victories against the Turks. He was popular, and he was not a noble. But he saw nobles being promoted ahead of himself. The opposition to this was the lower clergy and people like Anne of Savoy. The empire was losing territory to the Serbs and the Bulgarians, even Western Thrace under Ivan Alexander in 1371. But there was a huge opposition and a coup after in the capital that same year. The regent was stripped of all lands, but he had retreated into his fortress in Thrace. October of 1341, his backers proclaimed him the emperor against the young John. John the Regent then made war on the imperial family from Thrace. So it became a war between Thessaloniki and Constantinople. But the geographic division is not that important. The issue was usury. And the usurers supported the regent. And that's how they maintain their power and slowly take the property of the entire empire to themselves. And the war that came through this destroyed whatever options were left for the recovery of the city. Both Gregory of Palamas, the great saint, and Nicholas Kivisilis, in his oration against usury, said kind of the same thing. St. Nicholas argued that usury is taking from something that provides no value. It's taking from money itself, not the investment. The zealots and people like Palamas and Kivisilis argued that surplus funds beyond the necessities of the day are not owned by you. They're owned by the poor. There's no absolute right to property if it's more than necessary. And then you compound that when hoarding money leads to its release at interest rates. Since the greater the crisis, the greater the desperation. There's no such thing as a legitimate profit from something like this. In desperate times, in poverty, it's a contract without value because it's not freely signed. But by this point, the ruling class, with the exception of the zealots of that city, and they were not, anti-monastic, that's all mythology. If you go to my article on the topic, they're a very interesting group of people, but they were aware that the moral law had been rejected by the elites of the empire. That's the end of the empire and capitalism and usury, not in selling its soul to the West, or at least not precisely in that respect. When war breaks out, we're talking about a civil war here, the most irrational civil war of all time. The wealth gap, of course, increased. And it was seen as absolutely unnecessary. Two factions, the elite, fighting to see which one can profit from the common man. Kynikouzenos was the symbol of oligarchy. And, of course, the concentration of wealth is something that his rule associated with. But the zealots in Thessaloniki removed oligarchy from the city, and really in that last-ditch effort to save not just the finances of the empire, but the morals of the empire. John V was installed through Venetian cash and sought a union with Rome. That was just to get, he became a Catholic in 1371. So at least he was consistent, but that's easy access to Italian money. Andronicus IV, son of John, used the Turks to gain the throne while Italy had much to gain from this division. The main causes of this division were usury versus Christian economics, that was traditional Byzantium, urban versus rural, and landed oligarchs versus common farmers and craftsmen, which the zealots attempted to represent. The zealots were close to the hezekiahs, and vice versa. The hezekiahs were always poor, as the zealots respected. Zealots were led by local monastics. And even Thessaloniki, as a city and a region, had close ties with Athens through them. But the fact that Andronicus IV was willing to use Turkish force to capture power tells you the mentality of the age. The Turks were constantly taking territory of Byzantium. Now for his personal power drive, he's going to bring them right into the city. John V went to Venice, while Andronicus IV went to Genoa. Of course, those two were usually at war with one another. John V went to the papacy to make his deal. Emir Murad allied with Andronicus against John. And his early victories led to areas being granted, lands being granted to the Ottomans. And Murad went back and forth, John and back again. And Andronicus's reign was an absolute disaster. And then, of course, John V Palaiologos created an alliance with the Emir Sadukan. The wars devastated much of the what was left of the empire. And the Turks refused to fight for him anyway. But on the way back from sacking Bulgaria, the Turks came to Constantinople and demanded more lands and money for their quote-unquote service. And they were refused, which meant that the Turks razed the suburbs of the capital. Talk about an irrational enterprise, but this is how empires die. No one benefited from this. Maybe the Turks. Venice and Genoa, but especially Venice, controlled the money. The Byzantine coinage was gone. Since there was really no power in the capital, the entire civil war was for nothing. The fleet no longer existed. The treasury was worse than empty. The Venetians were willing to give money for the jewels of the imperial crown. So this was a war for non-existent power. The crown itself physically had to be sold for quick cash. These were extremely irrational times, but this is what self-interest does. But it didn't even serve the interest of those who were involved in it. Between 1321 and 1341, the wars became more violent. So you had a mortgaging of the state either to the Turkish regime or the oligarchs in North Italy. And that's where the Zealot Commune came from. Byzantium died from the sin of usury. But disintegration means the rise of another power, domestically and foreign affairs. It's an oligarchy. Without any central power or an ideological focus on the common good, elite factions gain as much as they possibly can before the entire system collapses. And it's very rare to find exceptions to this. The state lost legitimacy and was going to be the servant of overtly hostile powers. What happened after the fall of Constantinople? The factions that were able to rule, they didn't come from nothing. The rise of usury is essentially the rise of oligarchy. The empire fragmented in every way. Imperial coinage completely lost out. And actually, it was a Venetian gold ducat, which was the currency of the city by the 1360s, 70s. But the Zealots were one last-ditch attempt, and one that really didn't have much of a chance of working. The social war, even after that, there was even an attempt for people like Alexis Apokalkos, who was associated with the opposition to the oligarchy, was backed by the Zealots, but then he wanted to build a capitalist merchant state to imitate the Italians on the coast. He was murdered in 1345. But once the system broke down, the older landed interests turned to usury and loan sharking. I mean, the Latin feudal lords, to a great extent, were still there, to some extent. The secular lords of Byzantine Thrace and Macedonia had tremendous power over the population. And because of their imperial immunities, didn't really have anything to do with the state. They took and never gave. Even if they were, you know, mouthed loyal slogans to the central government, they didn't do anything for it. The central government was absolutely powerless. When you ignore the common good disappears. To the fate of the Byzantine Empire, theologically, politically, and economically, was the outcome of those two factions. But those two factions are the eternal factions, oligarchy and monarchy. Byzantine noble factions, the oligarchy, soon fell into the hands and the debt of foreigners. Foreign troops eventually terrorized villages that resisted. And they couldn't continue to fight for long. The war had become a national one, a Greek one. But the eventual fall of the city to the Turks, well, that was decreed in advance by the Greeks themselves. The Zealots failed because a coalition against the oligarchy just meant that the poor were cooperating with the merchant class against the landed oligarchy. And like everything else, it split into factions. The zealot leader, Michael Palaiologos, was lured into a trap and was murdered. The rebellion against Apokakos was brutal, as was the reprisal. And he was eventually murdered by the mob, the mobs of the city. So this has been a slightly different conception of the fall of Constantinople, both politically and theologically, and the relations between the two. I know it's very depressing, but it is a constant theme of this show and will always be a constant theme concerning everything I do. Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.